Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Peter Diamandis is back on to answer some of the most vexing questions anyone could ever hurl at somebody else. And I'm doing the hurling, but his answers are so damn satisfying. And anyone who's worried about the future and has kids and are kind of worried about what they're going to do should really listen to what he has to say, because I found it so damn enlightening. Also, some good XPRIZE talk in there, which I'm in love with. But before that, Carolla Digital Flash Briefing. Let me get to that. We got our own smart speaker, Daily Flash Briefing, sponsored by NetSuite, by Oracle, on your Amazon and Google devices. Easy to find on your Google Home device. Just say, hey, Google, play the Adam Carolla Show Daily Brief. For your Amazon Alexa devices, just go to Skills and Games in the menu and add the Adam Carolla Show Daily Brief. Then just say, hey, Alexa, play the Adam Carolla Show Daily Brief. Once you're set up, you can get daily clips from the show brought to you by our great partner, NetSuite. Am I right, Dawson?
There's a ton of uncertainty right now. NetSuite reduces it by giving you visibility and control. NetSuite by Oracle gives you a full picture of your business in real time. Get your free guide right now at netsuite.com/Adam. That's netsuite.com/Adam.
And now, Alcoa presents Definitely Not a Jew on the Adam Carolla Show. Dateline, Jacksonville, Florida. A 50-year-old man was arrested on charges of manufacturing, possessing, and threatening the use of a weapon or hoax weapon of mass destruction after he sprayed an unknown liquid on the entrance of a business from a bottle labeled COVID-19. Definitely not a Jew.
Peter Diamandis back on the show for a second time, because we just didn't have enough time to get in all that I felt like we could get in the first time. Good to see you again, Peter.
Good to see you too, Adam. Back by popular demand, no doubt. at least I enjoy spending time with you.
I feel exact same way. And I like your motif behind you, the Golden Gate Bridge. It's very soothing.
Thank you. Taken
from the Sausalito side, I'm guessing. So we were sort of left off talking about both of us big fans of the private sector and what they can do when motivated, and what motivates them is money, usually. And then there's the government, and we're discussing that, but the government is also there to grow, and they're also there to have more control. And anyone who's tried to do anything in the private sector or build anything, try to build anything in Southern California, you will realize that the government has a lot of rules and they don't speed things up for you at all. It all falls under the umbrella of safety, which they can hide behind. Safety. All the weak people hide behind safety. But what do we do? You have great beliefs in the private sector and innovation, and I love it, but I worry about the government not – I worry about the government putting a governor on it, slowing it down. What do you think?
We're going to have that conversation, okay? That'll be fun. So – Man,
it's both sides of the equation, and it's interesting, right? Because I think the internet exploded into its glory because there were no rules and the government wasn't ready to understand what the implications were. And so we saw this extraordinary, amazing emergence of the internet, the early days of AOL that you and I will remember back in the 90s. And it gutted and reinvented a whole slew of industries, from even mail service to information to reinventing libraries, all of these things. And so, yeah, the government, and there's an old saying, so I deal with the FAA in the launch vehicle and the aircraft business, and I deal with the FDA on some of the companies I'm dealing with in longevity and vaccines and therapeutics. And there's an old saying that they are not happy until you're not happy.
Right. Right.
And it's interesting, right? So one of my companies, Adam, I did years ago, I don't know if you've ever heard of a company called Zero G. We do weightless parabolic flights. Mm-hmm. And we, NASA had been doing it for 45 years since the late 50s. And back in 1993, I wanted to fly on NASA's Zero G airplane. It's this parabolic flight. You go up and down. It's called the Vomit Comet. We don't call it that. And
right. It's, and they would film Tom Hanks in outer space.
Apollo 13 was filmed there, and we filmed parts. Anyway, so I started the company in May of 1993. It took me 11 years to get FAA approval. Right. And it was this crazy battle, which was literally the FAA saying, listen, there's no way in the regulations that allow you to do this. And I'm going, there's nowhere in the regulations that disallow me to do this. So people are not motivated to approve things that are considered dangerous or different because no one inside the government benefits from that. Literally, it had to go up to the FAA administrator, Marion Blakey, who was an amazing woman. I was sending people to Russia to fly on an Ilyushin 76. They'd sit on the ground with a parachute on their back for takeoff and landing. And then finally, we got approval.
So you say on the ground, you mean on the floor of the plane.
On the floor of the airplane. And, you know, it was interesting. I used to go into battles with the regulators. And I would say, listen, I am not going to give up. You're going to either retire or die before I give up. And it was, I mean, it's that kind of a mindset sometimes that's required. But under periods of intense stress, like right now, we're seeing, so I've got two companies are involved, one in vaccines around the COVID-19 and one is around therapeutics. And we're beginning, I think there's a sense of, holy shit, we really need, the old way of doing things cannot survive. We need to take higher risk. And so the challenge is that higher risk comes with potential downsides, and the government's always trying to cap no downsides, right? So when one of the past heads of the DOT said we want zero deaths in airline, like 100% airline safety, there's only one way to do that. You stop flying airplanes.
Right. Yeah. Now, I agree. And the problem is us in the private sector, and I should tell people this, The Future is Faster Than You Think is the name of the book. It's available now on Amazon. It's about how technologies and businesses are being transformed and industries and our lives and just how fast things are changing in this society. And futureloop.com/C19 is where you can go to get some good news about what's going on in today's world vis-a-vis the COVID-19 situation when all we're hearing is bad news. But what I wanted to say about the government, and I've dealt with them a lot in building, and I couldn't imagine FAA or drugs. The other one was
FDA.
I couldn't imagine that. Just going to the Glendale building and safety department
gives you hives.
It's insane. It's insane. Now, and then what we're saying is this. I think we can all agree on basic safety things and basic sanitation things and things that make sense. I lived in a house, one of the first houses I bought, crazy Hollywood house, and it literally took about 75 stairs to get to the front door. And when I was remodeling the house, at some point I blew out a doorway to the bathroom downstairs. And the guy came in and he said, if you're going to replace the door, it's got to be a 32-inch door. And I said, well, I don't have enough room for a 32-inch door. And he said, yeah, well, you blew it out. So now you got to replace it with. And I said, the 32-inch door is a code for handicap access. It can't be a 28-inch door because you couldn't roll a wheelchair through it. And I said, yes, but nobody in a wheelchair is ever going to make it to this house because it's like those stairs in between the streets in Santa Monica that people run for exercise. It was literally 80 stairs to get to the front door. So nobody with a wheelchair could make it to this door threshold. And he's like, the code is 32 inches. And so that is unreasonable.
Yeah.
And I've had a million of those exchanges, and you have as well. And when you're dealing with the private sector, you're still interested in safety and you're still interested in progress, but you're also both reasonable because you want to get things done. Now, the government, and the problem with the government is the guy can say to me, the door's got to be 32 inches, rules are rules, and call me for an inspection when it's 32 inches, I'm leaving. And he leaves. And I don't get a certificate of completion until I do what he says to do. That's not the way the private sector works. And the government is not going to work any differently than that because they don't have to, and they're compelled to not. They don't care. So we have to do something that limits their control and limits their reach. And for some reason, we have a bunch of fucking dumb people who think it's a good idea to vote for bigger government, probably because they've never dealt with them like you and I have ever dealt, like you and I dealt with them. They live in fucking rent control apartments and don't give a shit. But what they don't realize is your companies that you represent are directly affecting them when you have those dealings with the government. Go.
Yeah. So, it is for sure
frustrating as hell when you're trying to make a difference on the planet and you've got this ability to do things faster, cheaper, better, and there's a brick wall that you hit all the time. And so the difficulty is even crazier than that. So I'm dealing with this in the world of the FDA. So for example, right now, if you have a new drug that is that has the potential to save lives and you want to make it available, you have this extraordinary long process that you have to prove it cannot do anything negative. And so while you're going through this process and it's the drug, you know, it's a decade of approval times, billions of dollars of work. And that period of time is one that people are dying from the disease you're trying to solve, but the FDA doesn't actually measure any of the deaths during the delay time. It only measures the deaths if you had used this drug, would it have killed somebody? So we don't have a fair and balanced view. So one of the things, for example, in the regulatory side, and we're all thinking about our health during this time, is I'm thinking around, you know, how do we create a accredited patient program? Right. So how do you create a program where you say, listen, I'm an intelligent person. I've read about this particular drug. My physician's read about this drug. My wife or my next of kin, and we all agree we want to try the drug. And why does certain government, you know, parts of the government control whether or not I can risk things with my own life, the things that are important for me? And that frustrates me to no end because it stifles innovation. And we think about the incredible world we're living in right now. And what I write about in the book is how rapidly it's going to change. We're going to reinvent healthcare, right? Again, we talked about the notion that it's not healthcare today, it is sick care. The system takes care of you after you are sick. And we're going to reinvent insurance, finance, food, energy, transportation, all of these things in a way that is going to make the world for each of us. It's going to become cheaper to do what we want to do. It's become more available and it's going to become more personalized. I mean, when you think about what Google and Amazon have done to our lives, it's amazing. And a lot of the great innovations, when you say, hey, name all the amazing things that are going on in your life, the powers that you have as an individual, what makes you capable to do things now that the wealthiest people in the world couldn't do 30 years ago, it is really the innovation coming from technology.
What do you think the government's role should be vis-a-vis information and, you know, Facebook and Twitter and Google? And some of these people are censoring some ideas, pulling some stuff down, labeling some other stuff. What are they doing? What is your belief? Like I, for instance, I'm friends with Dennis Prager. He's got PragerU. PragerU has several hundred videos. Many of them have a parental restriction on them that was placed there by Facebook or whomever, where they can't be shown in libraries or schools. These videos are G-rated nothing, but somebody disagrees with their content. And so they're censoring them based on the content, not based on the words. There's no swear words. There's no nudity. There's nothing provocative about them. How do you, what's your thoughts on the future of these platforms having some editorial license? You know what I mean? Like they're supposed to be. So what they are is, just to paint a real simple picture, they're supposed to be a platform, and the platform is a little plywood riser, and anyone can come stand on top of this box and preach whatever ideas they have, as long as they're not telling people to hurt each other or using this word or that word. And at some point, the guy who owns the platform says, I disagree with what that guy's saying. I think we're going to need him to come off that platform. And you go, but he's not inciting violence or doing anything. And the person who owns the platform is going, yeah, I'd like him to wrap it up. That seems kind of dangerous to me, and I'm not sure why they're doing it, but you tell me what your thoughts are.
So listen, I think that ultimately there's a transition in which a platform goes from being something that is for a small group, it's an experiment and such, where it becomes sort of things that people build businesses on, right? People build businesses on top of Facebook, for example, and it becomes more of a public service platform in that, and they benefit from all of it. So, I mean, the question is really, what is the role of government in censorship and regulation? And we talked about this last time we spoke, which was around the notion of how much responsibility does an individual have for, I don't like what Facebook is doing, I'm going to unsubscribe. I don't like, you know, what McDonald's is feeding, I'm not going to eat there. And I tend to go more towards empowering the individual to make the choices. Now, the question of the government, I think the government has a public safety requirement, but there's a reasonableness test. And I think there is an encroachment way forward. I'm more of a libertarian than I am anything else. And at the end of the day, I think the government has a role in public safety, but not to the extent that it is requiring and beginning to go against the First Amendment of freedom of speech. So
what do you think about the platforms themselves doing a little editing?
I do believe that there is, it's not black and white. I think that it is gray. And yes, when platforms are allowing hate speech and allowing elements that are driving people, like in Facebook, we've seen over the years, you know, increased suicide rate in teens and so forth. I think that it is possible for platforms to use AI to look for situations of bullying. And I think it is, when you have the ability to prevent that level of terrorism and hate and bullying and so forth, that it's an obligation of the platform to do that, to create a set of rules that say, as a platform, this is the way you're expected to behave. We don't allow that. If you don't like that, go to some other platform, and then to support those.
Right. But what I'm asking is sort of politically, it's not, okay. I think we all agree that somebody goading some youngster on to commit suicide is a horrible idea. And unless you're an ultra, ultra libertarian, you'd go, all right, take that down. But what if it starts bleeding into just sort of politics that you don't like? I think there was a story a couple of days ago where somebody said, this is in your wheelhouse, somebody said on Twitter, hey, this coronavirus, it's not as bad as we think it is, but people need to start thinking about getting back to work. And I think Twitter took it down. Like, they didn't like, they thought that was irresponsible. They didn't like the politics of that.
I don't agree that they should take that down. I believe that the community should be there. So, you know, when I'm on Twitter actively a lot, just at Peter D. Amandis, and the community shapes, you know, when I'm making comments about something in particular, I'm reading the feedback, and it moderates what I say next time. But I don't think that we should be taking it down. If they are, again, if someone is doing something that is dangerous or is goes beyond what are ethical and moral. But no, Twitter shouldn't be taking down an opinion.
Right. But here's the rub. The person that takes it down deems it as dangerous. See, we deem it as free speech.
Yeah.
And some ideas to consider. Like, yeah, we should be thinking about when we're getting back to work. We should be thinking about how many people are losing their jobs and livelihood. We should that is something that should enter our discussion. But the person takes it down, calls it dangerous. I'm telling you, you have to be careful, everyone listening. All this stuff is under the umbrella of safety. It's never under the umbrella of I'm in charge, I'll do what I want. It's always for the safety of the citizens or the community, we must X, Y, and Z.
And that's a slippery, dangerous slope.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
Let's talk X Prize.
Yeah.
I always should tell people you're executive chairman of the X Prize Foundation. I am so in love with the X Prize and the concept of the X Prize. I love this notion of taking problems, putting a little carrot at the end of the stick and sending the private sector to go fix it, solve it, beat it, whatever it is. Yours is, and I think the X Prize to me started off leaning a little more toward aviation.
Yeah, with space flight. Let me tell you the story. And by the way, Adam, given you're in here in LA, please come get involved. I'll tell you. So I grew up in the 60s, passionate about Apollo, passionate about space flight. That scientific documentary, Star Trek, really got me going about where we're going in the future. And I gave up on my chance of becoming a NASA astronaut. And I read one day Lindbergh's biography called The Spirit of St. Louis. And I find out that he flies New York to Paris in 1927 to win a $25,000 prize. And I go, that's it. I'm going to create a prize for private spaceflight. And $10 million was enough money. I was in the rocket business, in the space business. I knew that $10 million would be enough to spark an entrepreneur, but I didn't want the Boeings and the Lockheeds and the Airbuses going after this. I wanted teams that were new and a novel approach. So I announced a $10 million prize. I had no idea who was going to put up the $10 million. This is back in 1996. I didn't have $10 million at the time. And we ended up, I called it the X Prize, where the X was a variable to be replaced by the name of the sponsor, the Ortiz, the Pulitzer, the Nobel. Who's going to put up the money for this? And you had to build a private spaceship, carry three adults up 100 kilometers, land safely, and do it again within 2 weeks. And we had 26 teams around the world from seven countries who spent $100 million going after this. A guy named Burt Rutan of the Mojave Desert, backed by Paul Allen, wins the competition. I was able to recruit. And then Richard Branson came and bought the rights to the winning spaceship to create Virgin Galactic. And since then, we launched. Yeah, so Virgin Galactic came out of the original prize. And since then, we've launched about $200 million in X Prizes across the board. Wendy Schmidt, Eric Schmidt's wife, when the BP oil spill was going on back in 2010, Jim Cameron had joined our board and said, you got to do something about this competition, about this problem in the Gulf of Mexico. So we created a prize asking teams to reinvent how you clean up oil spills on the ocean before they hit the coastlines, before you destroy the fisheries and such. And so we had like 380 teams enter that competition. The winner increased the rate of oil spill cleanup on the ocean surface 600%. We did a prize for water. And, you know, we talk about water wars, water scarcity. But there's so much available water actually in the atmosphere. There's quadrillions of liters of water. So we said, can you build a device that pulls water out of the atmosphere and gives 1,000 liters per day in 24 hours for 2 cents a liter from all renewable energy. And that was won 2 years ago. We have prizes on reinventing how we produce food, on the rainforest, on energy, on CO2. I mean, it's amazing. And so if you go to xprize.org, you'll see the active X Prizes. And really, in this world of rapid exponential growth with all of these powers, that superpowers that individuals are having, right? You today have access to massive amounts of information. You could spin up 1,000 processor cores on Amazon Web. You have access to quantum computers on the cloud for free. We don't realize how much power that we have as individuals. So what we do is we say, here's a challenge, here's a goal, here's a target. If you solve it, you win. And these prizes range from a couple $1 million. Our carbon extraction X prize will be $100 million competition. We're in the middle of building that right now. And you win the money and the world wins the benefit.
Right. So when I was growing up, it was a lot of discussion about we're going to be out of fuel and the air is going to be so bad. So I grew up in Los Angeles. I remember what it was like in the early 70s. And it was basically, we're going to be out of fuel and the air is going to be so bad from what's coming out of the exhaust pipe of cars. Now, nobody knew is somebody was going to invent a catalytic converter and a computer that worked on engine management and advancing and retarding timing and blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the day, what comes out of a lawnmower is far worse than what comes out of a Ford F-150. It's 100 times worse. So we never knew that. We never saw that coming. All we saw is the technology we had, which is no catalytic converter, no unleaded gas, more and more cars, more and more pollution. And what you're saying is, the gestalt of what you're saying is there's so much technology and evolution, and it happens so fast that these problems, like there's no water, they can't get water in Africa. It's like, yeah, because nobody has thought about pulling it out of the atmosphere and having it being powered by a solar powered extraction. Yeah. And if you're thinking, well, we're just going to dig a hole in the ground and we're sucking all the water out, we can't get anymore. If you're using the old techniques, or you think about that way in terms of propelling an automobile, if you think of it that way, when I was in 1974, when I was 10, no one talked about solar power and Teslas and you know, wind farms or anything. It was just, we're going to be out of gas and then we won't have any cars. So you're saying that not only is that going to happen in the future, but it's going to happen so much faster, because what I'm talking about, we couldn't use a computer to figure it out.
I'll give you an example. So first of all, the world's biggest problems are the world's biggest business opportunities. I want people mm-hmm. to hear that, right? And what I talk about, that's what I teach in my Abundance Digital community and Singularity. And then if you want to become a billionaire, help 1 billion people. And those two forcing functions are really making the world much better at an extraordinary rate. And we have this negativity bias. We don't realize the extraordinary world that we're living in. All we're focused on is all the negativity all the time, because we talk about this. It's what the Crisis News Network feeds us all the time. So right. there was an environmental disaster in the 1880s and 1890s that was massive. As people were moving in from the rural area into urban downtown Detroit, Pittsburgh, New York, they were bringing with them their motive power, the horse. And as people brought more and more horses into downtown cities, the amount of horse shit literally was growing exponentially. And you can find articles that describe how awful it was, how bad it smelled, the disease that was coming from all of that. And it was the environmental disaster of those decades. And then it was solved in a very simple way. It was the car. The car right. came along and took away the need for horses. And now that's another disaster another issue that's coming. And people don't realize that we are in a period of exponential growth in solar energy. The amount of solar that we have, 8,000 times more energy that hits the surface of the earth than we consume as a species in a day, 8,000 times. It's not that there's not a shitload of solar energy out there. It's not in a usable form yet. And that's what technology is allowing us. It's making it cheaper and more usable and easier to install day on day on day. And so we will head towards a majority solar economy. that will transform it. And guess what? The poorest countries in the world are the sunniest countries in the world. And right. so they'll become net energy exporters. So we just have to reframe how we look at these things. And the same thing is true in every problem we have, at least in my opinion.
Well, no, it's a very good point. If you take the 10 biggest problems and then you'll have the 10 biggest companies solving those problems, if you think
Or you'll build companies in order to solve that and you will grow to become a major force.
Right, because we are wired to solve problems and we're wired for progress and we're unfortunately wired for fear as well. But what you're saying is if the problem is food going bad, then someone's going to invent a refrigerator. And then in the blink of an eye, everyone's going to have a refrigerator in their house because that's exactly. a major problem.
Yes.
So we're wired to notice the problems and then we're wired to fix and solve the problems as quickly as possible and then profit off it.
Yes. And that's what entrepreneurs define do. We make the world a better place by everybody. It's like, I teach people, okay, during this time of pandemic, when you see a problem, write it down and think about how do you start a business to solve that problem, right? It's a beautiful mind ninja move, right? Instead of seeing the problem, see opportunities and then go and solve it. So, you know, the challenge is really, we see problems far out in the distance. So for example, you use the example of catalytic converter, which about acid rain and all of those problems, the predictions, we saw what was going to be happening in 20 or 30 years, and people moved that prediction up to today as if the disaster is about to happen tomorrow. But what they forget is that during the interim time, people are solving problems, and the power that we have to solve problems, the tools that we have, again, now we have more tools than ever before. You know, back in the 70s, we didn't have AI and 3D printing and robotics. There's, you know, the problem of having access to enough ventilators. Guess what? People are beginning to 3D print ventilators and manufacture them in new and novel ways and open source them. When we see problems, we solve them. That's the world we're living in.
Right. So the problem with watching the news or oftentimes hearing what the experts have to say, going back to the catalytic converter, is they go, well, in 1974, the population of Los Angeles was 2.7 million and they had 1 million cars. Now the projection is in 25 years, it's going to be 10 million with 7.5 million. And according to my calculations, 7.5 million cars is 6 times as much as 1.5. And then we're going to have 6 times as much pollution in the air. But what they didn't count on is somewhere between now and 30 years, someone's going to invent a catalytic converter, and we're actually going to have less than we had in 1974 during the original prediction. So you can't just take what's happening right now and extrapolate it, because that would be like saying, well, the amount of time it takes to get from California to Oregon on a wagon train is 81 days. It's like, okay, so in the future, it's going to take 81 days for this many people. It's like, no, we're going to invent an airplane and we're going to do it in an hour and 20 minutes.
And we do that over and over and over again. Our minds are locally linear. We're living in a global and exponential world. And one of the things that, you know, is going to transform, you know, autonomous cars are going to transform where we live, how we live, the impact on the environment, all of these things. And so we just tend to take the way it is right now and project that forever. But I can guarantee you one thing, everything's changing, and it's changing faster and faster.
No, you know, it's always interesting whenever I see an Elvis movie where he plays a gun shooter from 1861. He has the same hair with the pomade, you know, combed back. You're talking about Star Trek, you know, seeing Shatner with the very 60s looking mop and everything. It's like, that's kind of what we do. We just kind of take the same styles and hair and stuff. And we just project it off into the future, a thousand years. And we're all wearing the same hairstyles we are now. It's like, yeah, that's how we work. Like, that's how we're wired. And I'm wondering, and I'm guessing that newer generations may not be wired that way. Like, my kids grew up around change and computers, and they're 13 year old twins, but I don't know, their concept, like, take the concept of asking them what they want to do for a living. When I was a kid, it had to end with the word man. You want to be a garbage man? You want to be a fireman? You want to be a policeman? I just thought there'd be a man job for me, you know? And it's like, construction man, fireman, policeman. You know, my son, he doesn't have a man at the end of his job title. He has anything he wants to do and probably nine jobs simultaneously. You know what I mean? It's a completely different world.
I have eight-and-a-half-year-old fraternal boy twins. And
oh, boy.
Yeah. And so, yeah, for them, they want to be YouTubers, game designers.
Right.
You know? So it's like, you know, it's interesting. But I guarantee you one thing, you can make a career out of anything these days. Truly make a career out of anything. I mean, you can make a career out of talking to people.
Their dad's a professional podcaster, so what am I going to tell them? You know what I mean? That'll never work. These harebrained schemes. You got to go to welding school. I'm telling you, welding, that's the future. But what about that? I'm a trades guy at heart. It's my background's in building. I've always been a little kind of Mike Rowe-esque on talking up the trades and talking up the sort of nobility of working with your hands. And one of the things about this future you're talking about, the sort of computer driven futures, we've all blown past all these plumber, electrician, carpenter, and all that kind of stuff, but stuff that can't be really outsourced and automated as easily. And we're all finding out now that during this downtime, we don't need professors, but we do need truck drivers, and we do need a guy to come in and unclog the drain if the toilet's backing up. What is your thoughts / predictions about trades and people doing that? You know, you got the Golden Gate Bridge behind you that I'm looking at right now. And, you know, that was built by a whole bunch of trades guys. Yeah. There'd be less of them building that bridge today, but they'd still need trades guys.
So there will be change. The question is, what is the timeline for it, right? We're going to see robotics playing more and more role. We're going to see AI playing a role. We're going to see 3D printing playing a role in a lot of different areas. But it's going to be the tradesmen and tradeswomen are going to need to partner with this technology versus get displaced by it.
Mm-hmm.
To do what they're doing faster, cheaper, better, and safer. And so I've seen brick laying machines, right, that can lay bricks much more precisely, much faster. One of the companies I've supported is it's a nonprofit. It's called New Story, and they 3D print houses.
Right,
it's $10,000 to 3D print a house, but it doesn't meet codes here. So it's homes in Mexico and South and Central America, the 3D printing that can withstand a category four or five hurricane, but it's different than what you're doing. But it is still a fundamental reinvention of how you manufacture homes. So one of the questions ultimately is, most people, you and I are lucky, we get to do what we love doing. For a lot of the world, people, their jobs are the job they could get to put food on the table and get insurance for their family. It's not what they dreamed about doing as a child. So,
no. And that's not just around, you know, I grew up with white people in Los Angeles in the San Fernando Valley. Very few of us are doing what we want to do. Many of the guys I grew up with are on a construction site right now. They didn't dream of that.
And so we're going to start to do two things. We're going to start to separate what do you do for because you love doing it versus what you do for a living. And we're also going to separate how you earn income versus what you do with your time. You know, I think that a lot of people are going to be able to spend time in partnership with AI, with robotics, with other tools, doing what they enjoy doing, creating. I'm not going to go into the laundry list of what they could do, but they're not going to be a cash register operator because Amazon Go is getting rid of that position. They may not be truck drivers in the future because autonomous cars are doing that. But if they want to, they could. But I think we're going to start to separate how we make your, how you earn your income. I think there will eventually be a version of universal basic income. I'm a libertarian capitalist, so the idea of socialism doesn't, you know, sit well with me, but I think we're going to have a version of that in the future.
Well, let's drill down a little bit on that. Because you're introducing some thoughts into my head, which is, I worked at McDonald's. I worked the grill exclusively at McDonald's. I did the grill. I made burgers all day. And then when we had downtime, they'd tell me to sweep and mop the dining area. Those are two jobs that are miserable. Miserable. Also, I worked cleaning carpets out of high school. Miserable cleaning carpets. And then I dug ditches, and that was miserable as well. Those are all jobs that are easily replaced by something other than a human being, right? I mean, you just don't, the cash register, these are all miserable jobs. So like,
they're called dull, dangerous, or dirty.
Right. The triple D's of jobs. And so the good news for all the people that are freaked out about no work in the future, well, the first stuff that's going to go is the dull, dangerous, dirty, and doesn't pay jobs. The most miserable I've ever been is the least I've ever been paid. You know, working McDonald's grill was, you know, $3.25 an hour. Cleaning carpets was $6 an hour, and digging ditches was $7 an hour. That's easily the least I've ever made in my life per hour, with the most, the highest misery index, with the lowest amount of pay. And the construction stuff was dangerous, crawling around underneath condemned buildings and digging footings and blah, blah, blah. So we're going to eliminate a lot of jobs that you don't wish upon your worst enemy, right? And so that's good news. On the other hand, where are these people going to go? How are they going to support themselves? And are we going to create this class that I'm already seeing it? You see it in California. You see it in the tech industry. You have ultra, ultra wealthy with third world type impoverishment living in the same basic area at the same time. Is that chasm going to keep growing?
So let me reframe this for you, because I think it's really important. There is a growing wealth poor divide, but that's not where we should be focusing our thoughts. So here's how I would describe, for all of human history, Adam, there was the king and the queen on the hilltop and everyone else in abject squalor, right? It was, or the pharaoh and all the slaves. I mean, it's just, for all of human history, that's what it was. It's only recently we start to have a middle class. And so I think about the notion that there is the have and the have nots was most of human history. And what's going on right now is we're going from have and have nots to haves and super haves.
Right.
Right. So we're raising the base where today the poorest people in America, if they want, still have access to things that the kings and queens and robber barons never had, whether it was a flushing toilet or air conditioning or even a cell phone. The poorest people in the world have access to the world's knowledge. And so what I'm fighting towards is, how do we create a world in which we uplift every man, woman, and child, where we meet the basic needs of every man, woman, and child? And yes, there will be people living for 1,000 years on Mars that are trillionaires. And that's okay, as long as we have a ability to uplift every man, woman, and child, so that a mother, when their children are born, know that that child has access to the best education on the planet, the best healthcare on the planet, all the food, water, energy that they want. And then it's up to them what they do with that possibility, because it's not the way it's been, but that is the way we can create. I call this, my first book was called Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. And it lays out the principles that this is where we're heading.
Well, so it's interesting. What you're saying is it's not that there isn't going to be a chasm. The question is what is the definition of poor? What is the definition of have nots? I mean, if you just look at it in a sort of micro way, I have a small business. I have employees. I make a shitload more money than they do, but ostensibly our lives aren't that different. They have phones. I have a phone. They have a nice TV. I have a nice TV. They have reliable transportation. They have access to medical care. They have entertainment. They have the same movies I see in the same theaters or on demand or whatever it is. It kind of pisses me off, to be honest. But we have the same life. I mean, yeah. I have a bigger house than they have. And I have a couple of Paul Newman race cars.
But and you have more of a pain in the ass responsibilities than they have, probably.
Right, but we don't really, our life isn't, my quality of life is not much better or much different than theirs. If you ask any one of us, what are you doing this weekend? Their answer formally would be, I'm going out to do this micro beer fest in Encino, and then we're going to go out to eat. There's a sushi place. It's got all you can eat if you get there. Now, the difference is their sushi place is all you can eat, but you got to get there before 7. And mine is, I'll show up at 9. I don't give a shit. But the point is, we're still doing the same stuff, and they're hopping on Southwest flights and going to the Bay Area.
They're flying in the air?
They're flying in the air.
Amazing.
On the That's same crazy. Plane. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm not trying to sound like an out-of-touch douche. I'm just saying their quality of life is ostensibly the same as mine. They have less square footage. I have more responsibility. It may even out in the long run. And so what you're saying is we're going to have to redefine what poor is. Just because you don't have nearly as much money as the next guy doesn't mean you're poor, or if you are poor, then it's moot because you have access to health care, water, food, shelter, air conditioning, cell phone, transportation. So it's academic if you're poor in a way. Am I couching that correctly?
It is the difference. We're demonetizing and democratizing all the things that used to call us money. So if you think about on your cell phone today, a kid, right? And there's more cell phones than there are humans. A poorest child anywhere on the planet on a feature phone, smartphone, Android phone, on that phone, that person has access to millions of dollars of shit that we would have had to pay for free, right? They have two-way video conferencing called FaceTime, which is amazing. I mean, we can video around the world for free. You have high definition video and still cameras and games and books and libraries. In the back of my first book, Abundance, I add up roughly how much you have, and you have millions of dollars of stuff that we disregard, that we don't think about. And that's what's happening. So the poorest people on the planet in the near future will be chauffeured around by an autonomous car. Energy will be free. The best education and healthcare in the world will not be delivered by some sage on a stage, some old guy sitting in front of you, boring the shit out of you. It's going to be delivered by an AI that knows the best and is the best educator for the poorest child or the wealthiest child. It's leveling the playing field in a way that's uplifting everybody in an amazing fashion. And people, you know, that's part of what I want to help people see that. So, you know, in my Abundance Digital community, that's what I'm trying to do, is help entrepreneurs understand where they can create value on the planet.
Peter, I know you have a heart out. That's a good note to go out on. I feel like we should just continue this series of conversations.
So I'm up for the next one, pal.
I'm a fan, and I'm now a bigger fan. And I just love your head on this stuff. And I don't know anything about technology, but I do know when someone makes sense. And you, my friend, make sense. So I'll let you bug out, and I'll give you some plugs and take care of a little business here. And hopefully we'll do this again very, very soon.
Let's do that. And I'd love to connect with you offline if we could.
Yeah. We're both in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So we'll make this happen. Thank you very much, Peter.
Take care, Adam.
I will tell you about Lightstream. That's what I wanted to say. Pay off those high interest credit cards with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Roll balances from multiple cards into one single monthly payment. Lightstream's credit card consolidation. That's what I want to say. Their consolidation loans. They have rates from just 5.5% 0.95 APR with auto pay, and there are absolutely no fees. So instead of all the super high rates on credit cards and other loans, roll them all into one place, consolidate them, take care of them with one payment, and pay as little as 5.95%. You can even get your money as soon as you apply, and you can get your money as soon as the day you apply. Apply today, get special interest and special interest rate and discount, and save money only with this discount code. Go to lightstream.com/Adam. That's lightstream.com/Adam. Right, Dawson?
Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5 auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/Adam for more information.
Ooh, Kyle Dunnigan is coming on Monday's show. So we got that to look forward to. And we're going to do some interesting technology that Chris has been monkeying around with as far as his face and the celebrities he portrays. So we'll keep you posted on that. You can go to Chassis, chassy.com, and check out all our movies. And you can pre-order I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available for pre-order on Amazon and other places you get books. And just go to amcroll.com for all the stuff you need. Peter Diamantes, everybody. The future is faster than you think. Very interesting guy, as you guys heard. It's available on Amazon and also his website, futureloop.com/C19 and abundance.digital. So until next time, this is Adam for Peter Diamantes and Gina Grad and Bald Ryan saying mahala.
Stick around. The Ace Man will be right back with Dave Damashek in today's episode of Good Sports. Podcast One Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi, hello, sports fans. Welcome to the Friday edition of Good Sports. Ready for some hot sports talk. Dave Damashek here from my, I hate the phrase man cave. I don't like it, but that's basically what I'm sitting in there. And then in his man cave, or his movie theater, inside his home. That's not just surviving, that's living. It's Adam Carolla. What's the poop, fella?
Just sitting here sort of drinking it all in. I don't like
literally drinking.
I'm having a cup of coffee. Yes. The proximity to my refrigerators is not helping. I find myself walking past my refrigerator 17 times a day and popping in like 9 times a day just to see what's going on, even though I ate 45 minutes earlier.
How's everybody doing in here? You goldfish all right? I'm going to eat some of you. Kettle chips, you're next.
Yeah, it's always just, I'll just get a spoon of peanut butter before I walk back to my office. But now that's 27 times a day. So I used to just leave the house and just go to work and not worry about it.
That's a great move, though. The spoon into the peanut butter is delish.
Is there anything better than the Laura Scudder's crunchy peanut butter?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that, first of all, like most people, I suspect that I'm going to emerge from this pandemic about 16, 18 pounds heavier than when it began. A pro tip for you, Ace, get yourself some of the little mini, like chocolate chip sized Hershey Kisses, you know, the real little ones. Throw maybe a half dozen of those on your spoon with the peanut butter. It's like, you know, it's like a homemade Reese's peanut butter cup.
Yeah, I can't. My problem, I realize, and if there was one thing I could probably change in my life is I've realized, and it ties into the whole pandemic thing. When I was young and when I was just a poor bachelor and worked and, you know, was gone all day, I would go hours without ingesting anything. I wouldn't take a sip of water. I taught boxing. I did construction. I was just on my feet. I was just gone. There wasn't, you know, when I did construction, there was a hose, you know, it's like a hose bib that they always have for mixing up concrete or whatever. And that was like outside and in the front and in the dirt. There was always a little mud puddle around it because the guy was cleaning his paintbrushes. And if you wanted to get a shot of water, you could get a shot from the hose. But there was no transport mug, travel mug. I mean, there's no anything. There's just nothing was around. So you just kind of would go hour upon hour upon hour without ever. I didn't have Tic Tacs or bottled water or anything. I wasn't mixing up, you know, Super C or there was nothing. No lozenge. No, just work. And now I find myself like going, well, I'm going to go downstairs and do the show. Oh, okay. Well, I get a cup of water, get a coffee, where's my stuff? And it's like, I'm not doing anything. There's no reason why I need my bottle and my thing. I'm getting into my car. I want my bottle. I want my thing. I find myself just kind of throwing something in my mouth all the time. Most of it is just habitual. I'm not really doing anything. Like, I sit in meetings in Beverly Hills, an air-conditioned office. I unscrew the cap. I take a hit of the water. I put the cap back on. I set it back on the table.
Why do we do that, though?
I don't know.
You don't do it with a much – the chance that the water is going to spill in a regular cup is much greater – then coming out of that little.
I'll tell you the worst one.
You put the thing back twisted on.
I'll tell you the worst one. And then 11 seconds later, I unscrew it again, take another hit. I'm burning zero calories in an air-conditioned room in front of a mahogany desk. What am I taking hits for all the time?
You need the design one where you actually are getting a workout when you unscrew it.
Oh, like that's a good
building
point.
Up them forearms. The Adam Engine. Carolla forearm buster.
The one that's the worst with the cap is when you do stand up, you go out there and you realize someone puts a bottle of water on the stool and you're talking and fomenting and yelling and spittle and everything. And at some point you go for the bottle, but you realize you're holding the mic while you're over at the bottle. And then you realize, oh, this is a two-hander. Like, I'm going to have to put the mic, I'm going to set the mic down on the floor and like undo that one should always just be off. There's nothing going on the stage that would pollute. All right. What do you got, Jeff?
Well, people started hitting me up. Some NHL writer floated his favorite hockey names. And I don't know if you remember when we used to do the radio show. I liked a couple of names. I used to sing about Temu and Chichu. But that's really the tip of the iceberg. Those might be the name Hall of Famers, but there are a lot of great hockey names. People ask me to not just list mine, but to say them. They like to hear me say them. I'm going to do you one better. I'm going to provide my favorite hockey names of all time, if you'll indulge me. We're off of work. We're working right now. But so it feels a little bit like a holiday. So if you'll indulge me, I'm going to go with a holiday classic as my tune here, and I'm going to give my favorite names here. Ready? Here we go. Darren Poopa, Ron Tugnut, Stan Smilsaku, Koivu, Capo Kako, Miko Makala, Harold Snepsan, Rick Zombo, Eddie Mio, Gump Worsley, Rajo, Ruotsalainen, Tuomo, Temu, Solani, Chichu, Anže Kopitar, Per Juus, Ilkka Sinisalo, Krupp Bonk, Darcy Wakalak, Håkan Lubb, Hector Marini, Urbe, Valapukin, Zarli, Zalapski. I fell apart there in the end, but I think you can see that the spirit is there, and that's what matters most.
I don't feel like anyone has ever done that in the history of Earth's existence, and they couldn't have before this because those guys didn't exist. Not the entire list, no.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and not she did it to Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
I see.
But yeah, probably the same people, but different rhythm, different theme.
I mean, everybody seizes on, like, listen, those Scandinavian ones, like Saku Koivu and Kapo Kako, and, of course, our beloved Temu Solani, those are great. But let's not miss out on the Hector Marinis of the world and Darren Poopa. and Stan Smith. I mean, these are great. These also, my favorite one, though, I think, my two favorites. I love Tamu and Chichu for nostalgia at this point, our own created nostalgia. But beyond those two, what do you like better, Ace? I'm going to let you split the make the decision here. Ilka Sinisalo was a he passed away actually a few years ago. Was a for the hated Philadelphia Flyers, and then the other one, Raijo Ruotsalainen.
Ilka Sinisalo, Raijo Ruotsalainen was it? I like alliteration, so I like the R and the R. R and R.
How about that guy's name? He's a little fella, too. He's about 5'7", played defenseman. Raijo Ruotsalainen. Oh, listen, there are no losers here, except
me. Can I say this about hockey? The skill level is really incredible now. The speed and the skill level. People always talk about football, like, oh, these guys are so much bigger and faster than Alex Karras was. And they talk about basketball, like, hey, these seven-footers are draining threes, you know. But hockey, the speed and the puck handling, just go back and watch Miracle, and not the movie, but, I mean, one of the things they just watched, they replayed the Miracle on Ice. Now those guys are college guys, but they're going, some of them are going to the show. And it wasn't, you know, in the 40s, it was 1980. And the game looks slow. The Russians look slow. Everyone looks slow compared to what you see today in the NHL, right?
Well, I'll tell you this, because I've talked to it, name drop coming up. I've talked to none other than the greatest player on the face of the earth, Sidney Crosby, about this. And he said the game isn't really even, I don't know if he said as much fun, but it's much harder, he was talking about, because even versus when he came into the league, the defensemen couldn't skate as well. And the, like, you know how they shift in lines of three.
Right.
The third and fourth liners were much more like mucker types. They were there to bang you around and try to slow you down with an elbow or get you into a fight or check you. But he said everybody now skates. And ironically, it's made the game, you're right, the skill level is higher than it's ever been. But now there's no room anymore. You don't see like the Lemieux, Gretzky era when, I mean, they would just embarrass guys. They would like turn these defensemen who couldn't really skate, they would make them look foolish out there, sort of like the Globetrotters playing the Washington Generals. Now everybody's so good and so skilled, it's hard to even find room out there. But anyway, yeah, it's a keen observation. Hockey is almost too good now so that even the best players don't have room to like have the highlight reel kind of stuff like you see Lemieux and Gretzky and those guys. But talking about names, one last thing before we wrap it up here to help you and the audience out here before we see him in his Tampa Bay uniform. Did you know former Patriots QB, now Buccaneers QB, Tom Brady? Have we talked about the fact sometimes you go to their pages and it lists nicknames for these guys? Like Peyton Manning was the sheriff. I don't know if I've mentioned this to you before. Tom Brady, his nickname apparently, the Pharaoh. So please start calling him the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh. Yeah, something stinks in Denmark. I don't know where that phrase is from. Is that Shakespeare? Either way, wait, Tom Brady just magically at 40 or whatever he is now the Pharaoh? Weird.
Isn't that an Egyptian king?
Yeah, self nickname, go ahead there, Ace. It's all the rage.
But wasn't he Tom Terrific or something?
Yeah,
like
he already
that?
Has one, but now he's the Pharaoh. If you go to Pro Football Reference, I saw it the other day, and I just love the idea of like, who does anybody fact check this? Like, does anybody call Willie McGinnis or Randy Moss and say, any knowledge of anybody ever calling Tom Brady the Pharaoh?
First off, pardon me, but half the guys in the league are going to have no idea what a Pharaoh is. They're going to think you're talking about Jay Pharoah, the SNL cast member. Pharaoh, he's not funny.
You're so right. You know what? Forget the Pharaoh. I'm sticking with Rick Zombo, Saku Koivu. That's where the good names are at. We'll be back for you. Good Sports will be back for you later, sometime next week. But good times catching up, Ace. Stay safe and sound under your roof there. Same to you, Gary, Kalen, and everybody else listening to us right now. Thanks for checking out Good Sports. We'll be back with more for you next week. Until then, for Adam Carolla, Dave Damaschek, Good Sports out. Good Sports.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744 and get everything you need at adamcarolla.com.
And before we get out of here, one more thanks to Geico. Do you own? Do you rent? What do you do? Do you want a bundle? Well, you own or you rent, or you got to have insurance. You got to have auto insurance. Bundle it. Make it easy. Save money. Let's get it under one roof at Geico. At geico.com, get a quote. See just how much you could be saving on your homeowners and your rental insurance when you bundle. That's Geico, geico.com.